Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Hi, folks. Here today with me is one of my very favorite people in the world, Dan Pink. Dan, of course, is the best-selling author of To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. He's also the best-selling author of Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. He is a really smart writer. He's a really smart thinker. He is always working on something that's useful, that's interesting, that we can talk about. And I, you know, without further ado, there's other things I could say about him. He's created great TED Talks. If you go to his website at danpink.com and you even look at resources, that page is a brilliantly designed and really interesting page to look at. In any event, Dan, welcome so much to the podcast.
Peter, thanks for having me. Thanks for that nice introduction.
It's my pleasure, and it was easy to do. Let's talk about To Sell as Human as a start. It's your most recent book, bestseller. What motivated you to write it? What's the big idea behind it?
Well, there are two different questions. What motivated me to write it were a couple of things. First, I looked at my own work and realized that a lot of what I was doing every day was selling. I wasn't necessarily trying to sell a book, although I was doing that too, obviously, but I was persuading, influencing, convincing, cajoling. I was dealing with editors, trying to talk them out of a bad idea. I was trying to get my son to take out the garbage. I was trying to pitch an idea to somebody. And I realized if I'm doing this all the time, a lot of people are doing it all the time. And if you look around, I think that a lot of the books about sales are not very good. They're not very substantive, and they also, I think, are a little bit duplicitous. So I said, okay, I'm going to try to write a book about sales, maybe for people who might never read a book about sales. So that was the motivation. The big idea behind the book is the following, that it's really two twinned ideas. First, I really think that sales, again, whether we're talking about pitching ideas, whether we're talking about influence, whether we're talking about persuasion, or whether we're talking about actually selling a product or a service, I think that sales has changed more in the last 10 years than the previous 100. And the big change is that most of what we know about sales has come from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer. When the seller has more information than the buyer, the seller can rip you off. That's why we have the principle of buyer beware. But what's happened in a really swift way that a lot of people haven't fully grokked in the last 10 years is that we've gone from this world of information asymmetry to one in many, many markets for many, many things, a world of information, or at least close to information parity, where sellers and buyers are more evenly matched. And to my mind, that's a world of seller beware. So one idea in the book is that we've moved from buyer beware to seller beware. The other idea has to do with, okay, this is right. What do you do about it? And for that, I looked at this very interesting trove of research in behavioral science to try to figure out what are the personal qualities that are necessary to be effective in this remade landscape of information parity and seller beware, and what are some of the smaller practical tactical things we can do to be more effective.
So this idea of what you do about it, I think you handle brilliantly in the book, and I think it's a challenge, right? Because
heck yeah.
You know, people read a book and they go, well, that was really interesting. And, you know, 99% of the time don't actually do anything differently. How do you, I'm so interested in this line between what we know and what we do, called sort of the limbic space that we have to pass through from knowledge to action.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your thoughts on it. Like, how do we get through that?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. And one of the things that I've tried to do in all of my books is bring those two worlds together, because I think that each world needs each other. I share the frustration of reading a book, maybe that's a big idea, and it's like, oh, this is cool, interesting, okay, great, wow, okay, yeah, I never thought about it that way. And then you get to the end and you're like, hey, what am I supposed to do? And a lot of times the writers won't stoop to have that conversation with the reader. Meanwhile, there's other kinds of books that are all, you know, that are entirely how-to, purely directive, purely instructional, and you look at those and you say, well, how do you know? And so what I try to do is, as you're saying, is kind of bridge that gap, marry those two things. Write a book that gives readers a different way to think about the world, a different lens, a different frame, whatever, but then tries to answer that question, okay, if I'm right, or again, as in most things, if I'm more right than wrong, what do you do about it? And try to offer some practical, tactical advice for people. And my view is that the big ideas make the takeaways, let's call them, the big ideas make the takeaways more likely to be taken away because there's a rationale for them. Meanwhile, I think that the takeaways, especially if people put them into action, end up clarifying and deepening the understanding of the big ideas. So I think that they work together. I think they belong together. I'm as puzzled as you about why we have these currents that keep pushing them apart.
You know, as you're talking, I'm realizing, and I hope this doesn't in any way insult both you and me in terms of how we write our books, but you know, the genre of book that does what you're saying very, very well is diet books. You know, like if you look at any diet book, the first half of it is here's the logic behind the diet and how you should be eating and why you should be eating and the research behind it. And the second half of the book is, okay, now what are you going to do to lose the weight? Or what are you going to do to, you know, to kind of put these ideas into practice? And it's actually like, that's the basic form of the diet book. And it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it depends, you know, I'm somewhat skeptical for a lot of those kinds of books about that first half, about whether what they're representing really is something new and fresh.
It's a good point.
If you look at some of these people who have written diet books, and there's one guy who I'm spacing out on his name, but you know, he's written like 8. Okay. And so it's like, what was wrong with the first, you know, like what did you get wrong in the first 7?
It's a very good point.
And so I think that you're right. And I think there are a lot of people out there who might look down their noses at that. And I don't, I actually, whatever, I don't know what the opposite of looking down your nose, looking up your nose,
right.
whatever that is, you know, I think those are the books that I like to read. Those are the books that I find valuable in my own life. Yeah, you know, and essentially I would never write a book that I myself didn't want to read.
Right.
So this book, To Sell as Human, I wanted to read this book. So it didn't exist, so I wrote it.
Excellent. And I have to say, I just recommended it to a client who isn't fundamentally in sales, but this idea, the three main points that you talk about in the book, you know, sort of attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. The idea of like really being connected and empathic, really being able to support yourself. I'm really simplifying it, and the clarity to really, you know, have a message that's super clear. It really is important whether you're in sales or not, and it's a critical piece to how we communicate and how we live our lives. So to have those ideas and then not apply them seem to really miss the point, because the idea is that they've got to be applicable.
Exactly.
Right.
So again, you know, I think there's a concern among some writers, among the big idea writers, in that they feel like they're slumming it if they offer some amount of direction, some amount of instruction, 1 or 2 or 3 takeaways. And you see this sometimes in books themselves, where you read a book and then the very last chapter, you know, it's maybe 3 pages long, is here's what to do about it.
Right.
You can smell it. You can, the aroma, you just barely crack open the book and you can smell the aroma of how it got there, which is that the person's editor said, okay, this is pretty good, but you haven't given the reader anything useful. I don't write those tell me, you got to do, okay, I'll put on a grudging three-page chapter. And the editor says, oh, what the hell, I'll just go ahead and do that, and that'll be fine.
I love it, and I could see it happening. I see the image.
Oh, it happens all the time.
Right.
I mean, I could pull books off my shelf or in the giant stack behind me, which actually I think has your book in there somewhere.
Oh, that's good. I think I see it in the middle of the middle pile.
Yeah, right over there. See that?
That's great.
You know, so you can pull a lot of books off the shelf that have that grudging, here are the takeaways chapter.
I'm glad you do it. I mean, and it's an art, actually, to be able to have, to be a good enough writer to share the ideas and the research in a way that's compelling and interesting, and be able to apply it. I actually think there's a skill to both of those, and they're two separate skills. I think you do both really well.
Oh, thanks.
I have a question as I was thinking about this conversation, and I was thinking about To Sell as Human, which I really liked, right? It's the surprising truths behind what motivates us.
About moving others.
About moving others. Thank you. About moving others. And then the surprising truth about what motivates us, which is drive. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about motivation, because I think, you know, motivation, this is we're talking to leaders and the idea of helping people have autonomy and mastery and purpose are the sort of three legs of the stool to create motivation, or to create an environment in which someone can be self-motivated is a better way of thinking about it, I think.
Exactly.
And I wonder, though, because you think about selling someone on something is a way of motivating them. And I'm wondering about the crossover between these two books, because they share very different ideas. And yet you can look at it and say, well, what is motivating someone other than selling them on an idea and getting them engaged? And I'm wondering, you know, in your having written both books, where the interplay is between them, if there is one.
I definitely think that there is. I think there's, and I like the way you put it as sort of an interplay rather than a Venn diagram. I think that's it's a more dynamic relationship. I think fundamentally there's something like, you know, let me try to be more concrete. So in the Into Sales Human, I write about using questions as a persuasive tool. When do questions work as a persuasive tool, and why do questions work as a persuasive tool? And questions work as a persuasive tool under certain circumstances, because questions by their very nature elicit an active response. So if I ask you a question, even if you don't respond directly, your wheels turn a little bit in a way that they might not if I was to simply ask, making a statement. Let's make it even more concrete. Ronald Reagan in 1980, he was running against Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was the incumbent president. Reagan had an argument. He had a sales pitch. Carter screwed up the economy. Now, he could have said that, or he could have said your economic situation has worsened in the last 4 years. But instead, he did something rhetorically brilliant that now has a body of social science helping us understand why that's the case. He said, ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? He asked a question. And what happened there is that people started thinking about it. Not every single person, but they said, let's see. 4 years ago, I was in this situation. Today, 1980, I'm in this. Oh my gosh, I'm in much worse shape than I was 4 years ago. And here's the key point here. Those people came up with their own reasons for agreeing with him. And when people have their own reasons for doing something, their own reason for believing something, rather than your reasons for doing it, they believe those reasons more deeply. They adhere to the behavior more strongly. Now, this is, again, a wonderful interplay with some of the research on motivation, particularly this aspect of autonomy. People are more likely to engage in writing software code, or in working in a call center, or in being a nurse when they have some measure of autonomy, when they have some self-direction, when they're doing it for their own reasons. There is this wonderful interplay between these two sets of ideas. And even more to sort of see you and raise you on this, I think that both of these go to the heart of what it is to be human. We want to have some sovereignty over our lives. We want to have some control over what we do. And instead of resisting that, and many motivational mechanisms are controlling mechanisms, a lot of management is ultimately about control. The same thing is true in a world of information asymmetry, when the seller can try to control the buyer. And I think what I think the world that we're living in now says control doesn't work very well. It's harder to have control today. But the dirty little secret is that if you allow some self-direction on the part of other people, if you can create an environment in which they make their own choices, reach their own conclusions, you can still do really, really well.
And I think it's interesting, if anyone listening here, if you read Drive and then you read To Sell Is Human, to go back to Drive and look at it and to sort of think about these two books together, because I think they inform each other in a really interesting way and dance together in a really interesting way. You said something earlier in this conversation that struck me, and it's a little personal, but I want to ask you about it, because, you know, I've had conversations with editors or with publishers, and they have an idea and I have an idea and I sort of disagree with them. But then I think, you know, look, I've written and had published 3 books. You know, they've done hundreds, so they probably know better than I. And I go with them, and I haven't found that always to be the best move. And, you know, you sort of said, I use the skills in To Sell Is Human to convince an editor out of a bad idea. And I'm wondering about the other side of it, which is the confidence and clarity that you come to where you're in that situation and you're saying, you know what, I'm actually gonna, like, yeah, they might have more experience having published more books than I've been involved in, but ultimately I know this is the right way to go and I'm going to push for it. And I don't even exactly know what the question I'm asking is, but there's something that's behind persuasiveness, that's a belief in self or a belief in ideas. And I don't know, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's this old adage that the best approach is to argue as if you're right and listen as if you're wrong. And I think that's pretty, I don't know who said that, but I think it's, you know, and I try to, I don't usually do that, but I, you know, in my better self tries to do that. And so if you have, if you're dealing with, you know, I think one should respect expertise in any realm. People who have expertise know more than people who don't have expertise. Now, by the very nature of being an expert. However, that doesn't mean that one should defer to experts at all times, because there is also evidence, some very interesting work, that experts tend to be much more closed-minded than some of us. And so, you know, I think like most things in life, it's a little bit of a crapshoot. You're basically making judgments, you're making risk assessments. So you're basically saying, how confident do I feel in pursuing line of argument? Also, how important is this line of argument? In any kind of negotiation, you're gonna be okay giving some stuff up, and you're gonna be not okay giving other stuff up. But you try to gather as much data as you can. But ultimately, for a lot of the stuff, particularly in the book business, some large measure of it is just gut decision making. I would not have. You know, I happen to have read because I had a next door neighbor who got one of the, you know, an early, relatively early copy of the first Harry Potter book. Said it's the greatest thing. And I ended up reading my next door neighbor's copy of Harry Potter, like in the first couple of months that it came out. And I was like, whatever, you know, I mean, if that manuscript had crossed my desk as an editor, I don't know, it's a nice little story, but I wouldn't have said, oh, this is going to be the greatest phenomenon ever. You make your bets and hope that over time, I mean, I actually look at it fairly mathematically. You sort of assess the risk, the percentages, the odds, the probabilities, make your bets in a smart way, and hope that over time you end up with a net positive.
And that's the probabilities. You know, I just spoke with Phil Tetlock, who wrote Super Forecasters, which is a great book.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's back here too.
Next to mine. Look at that. Is it?
Where is it?
It's got to be somewhere in that big pile of books. Those of you that can't see, Dan and I are on a video Skype, even though you're hearing the audio, and we're looking at about 1,000 books behind him.
I don't know if you can see it through there.
Several piles. There it is. Yep, I see Super Forecaster. So your piles of books and my piles of books are not dissimilar.
Yeah.
That's the premise of his book, right? Which is that you've got all these experts, and then you have these regular people who are better at forecasting than the experts.
Exactly.
And I guess that alone should give us the confidence to pursue, you know, with some strength, our convictions, even if some people disagree with them. As you said, listen to the disagreement and play the probability.
Well, you know, there's another famous line. I think it's from, I'm going to paraphrase it, I'm going to get it exactly right. It's from William Goldman, who was a screenwriter, who talking about Hollywood and the movie making process. And his line was something like, nobody knows anything.
Right.
Which is generally true.
Right. That is a great line. It's the old Mark Twain quote too, which is that if you read the newspaper, if you don't read a newspaper, you're uninformed. If you read a newspaper, you are misinformed.
Nicely. Yeah, that's good.
Let me ask you a question about, I was thinking about this as I was reading, and you may or may not have an answer to this, but as I was looking through again, Drive, and thinking about this idea, which I so believe, which is people aren't motivated by money. Actually, if you look at the evidence, money can be demotivational. What you have to do is pay people enough to take the money issue off the table and then get to work. And the evidence to that is so compelling. And yet, when I look at organizations that I go into, it's evidence that's for the most part ignored. And I'm wondering whether you have any observation about that. It's in terms of why, you know, if we've got the evidence that says take money off the table, pay people enough and then take money off the table, and yet people are still being paid with bonuses and people are still trying to motivate people with money.
Well, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, because money is a motivator. It's, you know, people respond to money. There's no question of it. But they don't always respond the way that we want them to, or the way that is best for them or for an organization. And more important, it sort of goes to what we were talking about earlier. Really what the research says, I think that money, let me put it another way, money is a little bit of a head fake here. What the research says pretty clearly is that there's a certain kind of motivator we use in organizations. Psychologists, economists call it a controlling contingent motivator. I call it an if-then reward. If you do this, then you get that. 50 years of science tells us very clearly that if-then rewards are very effective for simple short-term tasks, okay? Algorithmic tasks. So using money as a motivator for someone stuffing envelopes, pretty good idea. Pay him per envelope, all right? We love money. We love rewards. They get us to focus. The problem is, as you're saying, is that if-then rewards are far less effective for more complex creative work with longer time horizons, because we don't want to look narrowly at a problem in that case. We want to look expansively. You know, so money really, really matters. And as you say absolutely correctly, you got to pay people enough. You got to pay people enough. You got to pay people enough. You got to pay people well. But once you pay people well, it turns out that holding out additional units of money doesn't have a huge effect, if any, on additional units of performance for these more complex creative tasks. So all of which is to say, let me answer your question, which is, okay, so why aren't enough organizations closing this knowing-doing gap that you and I have been talking about? I think the reasons, there are many reasons for it. One, remember, some of these if-then rewards can be effective for certain kinds of tasks. So we get faked out by that. So we use them for these more algorithmic tasks and they work. And you're like, of course they worked. Then we use them for these non-algorithmic tasks and we say, oh, they didn't work very well. But instead of saying maybe we should try a new approach, we say, huh, I guess that means we need more carrots. I guess that means we need more sticks, you know? And so that's one reason is that we're sort of faked out by the fact that they do work in some instances, but that doesn't mean they work in every instance.
And actually what you're saying is fairly brilliant, because it's like what they're doing is the solution to their problem isn't working, so they add more solution.
Bingo. That's exactly it. Rather than recognizing that you need a different solution. I think that's one big trap. The second big trap is, you know, I mean, you know this better from your own work than I do, but there are, you know, if you look at especially public companies, they are obsessed with the short term. They are myopic. And I have terrible vision. I'm wearing, for your millions of listeners who don't know this, I'm wearing glasses. And I wear glasses or contacts all the time because I literally like can't see my computer screen from, you know, 1 foot away. All right. So they're more myopic than I am. They're incredibly short term. And the fact of the matter is that these high stakes contingent rewards get people to move in the short term. So if I'm a sales manager and all I care about is having my sales team hit their numbers for this month, I should offer the biggest, stinkingest bonus I could possibly give them, because they'll hit it. They might screw the company over the long term. They might pull orders in from other areas. They might rip off the customer. But if all I care about is the short term, then I should do that. So that's another reason. And I guess the other more pernicious reason is that it's easy, you know? If I, you know, say that you're my boss and you want to motivate me, you want me to do something, you can say, Dan, do this, then I'll give you a big bonus. That's really easy. If you really want enduring motivation, you have to say, who is Dan? What level of autonomy is right for him? What type of autonomy is right for him? How can I help him achieve mastery? How can I give him feedback to help him make progress? How can I help him discover why he's doing what he's doing, along with how to do it? That's really hard.
You know, it's actually when I talk about this movement from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to then conscious competence. You know, this idea that in order to learn something, it's actually, again, really, really interesting what you're saying, which is that if you're going to really learn something, you actually have to slow down. You have to try stuff that you're going to fail at. That's that probability. I mean, it's the same thing that you were talking about with your editor, which is, you know, you're going to advocate for certain things. You may be wrong, but so you may be wrong. Like you're allowing for some percentage of error and failure, but you're not giving your autonomy up in order to avoid all of that failure. And you're moving forward. It's But it takes slowing down. It takes holding To Sell as Human in your hand and reading it right before a sales call or a conversation you know you have to sell someone on, and thinking through, what kind of questions am I going to ask? How am I going to approach this? And if you don't take that time ahead of time, you'll never change your behavior. You'll never get to unconscious competence, right? To this ability to just do it the way you do the wrong things.
Bingo. I love that.
Dan Pink, thank you so much for being with us. Is there anything that you want to share with people? Any new things you're working on? Any ways of getting in touch with you?
The best way to stay up to date on what I'm doing is to follow me on Twitter, or even better, sign up for my free email newsletter, which you can find at danpink.com.
I highly suggest the newsletter. It does not come offensively much. It comes sporadically much. And there's always a lot of value that you send out in it.
Great. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you. Dan Pink, he wrote To Sell as Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. He also wrote Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. He also wrote several other books. I imagine you know him. If you don't, find him. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.